This lecture, entitled Evolution and the Divine Creation, is dedicated to the merit and honor of the Schwab family. If one would have to isolate one idea, one single concept that defined and shaped the modern era, the laid its foundations and supported all or much that is associated with it, it would have to be Charles Darwin's theory of evolution. Referred to by one writer as, quote, the single best idea that anyone ever had, end quote, and other superlatives, probably no idea in history has ever been so well received and accepted with such wide enthusiasm. For the millions who based their lives on it, it felt not only intuitively correct, but also it introduced them to what they felt was boundless freedom and happiness. And with such simplicity, without an interfering God or intrusive intelligence, just with a simple law of nature, life kept on progressing slowly but surely, era after era, from the most basic and simple organisms to the most complex. To its adherents, any belief in a divine creator, intelligent designer, was merely myth and superstition. Science and nature had the answer for life's deepest mysteries, origins, and purpose. Even till today, despite all of its inherent difficulties, with relatively rare exception, Darwin's theory of natural selection has become accepted fact by virtually the entire scientific community. Darwin's main thesis was that over time, small superior features in a single individual organism will eventually cause the descendants of that organism to dominate over its peers and eventually replace them. And continued improvements of their descendants will in turn cause them to dominate until the accumulated changes will be so profound that these descendants will no longer resemble their ancestors, bringing into being a whole new species. But Darwin took this idea, which has much evidence on a small scale, within a certain species or perhaps even genus, and expanded it to encompass every single form of life. According to Darwin, over time, the most simple organisms change slowly but surely into the most complex. Accordingly, everybody and every living thing, animal, plant, bacteria, fungus, all came from a single simple organism that branched out until it produced the multiplicity of organisms that we see today. In the final analysis, then, we are all related. Just in case you felt you had too few relatives, mazel tov. Rest assured now you have many. The dust mites that you breathe, the chicken and potatoes that you eat, and the flies that you chase away are all your cousins. In a sense, the theory of evolution contains with it very mystical and quasi-religious concepts, progress, unity of being. But at the same time, it views the world as a terribly brutal and competitive place, with the progress achieved by the survivors coming at the cost of the death of all the others. In Darwin's concluding words of The Origin of Species, quote, "Thus, from the war of nature, from famine and death, the exalted object which we are capable of conceiving, namely the production of the higher animals, directly follows," end quote. It is this struggle and eventual progress that Karl Marx so treasured. In a previous lecture, we quoted a letter that Marx wrote Darwin, asking him that he let him dedicate his Das Kapital in Darwin's honor. In a letter that Marx wrote to his associate Frederick Engels, in which he describes Darwin's Origin of Species, he writes, quote, "Although developed in a coarse English manner, this is the book that contains the foundation in natural history for our view," end quote. In other words, Marx viewed the class struggle as being a continuation of Darwin's struggle for survival within nature. Adolf Hitler based his whole racial theories and his vision of the ultimate domination of the master race, the Germans, on Darwin's view of the world. In Hitler's own word in Mein Kampf, the stronger must dominate and not blend with the weaker, thus sacrificing his own greatness. Only the born weakling can view this as cruel. But he, after all, is only a weak and limited man. For if this law did not prevail, any conceivable higher development of organic living beings would be unthinkable. End quote. So if you thought bad about being wiped out, you should find this in the Chum as your consolation. Charles Darwin had an amazing effect on countless other individuals, many of whom impacted on millions. One of them was Joseph Stalin, a man responsible for untold misery and death. Although he was originally a theology student, like Darwin himself, Darwin's theory transformed Stalin's life and, unfortunately, many others. In 1940, a book was published in Moscow entitled Landmarks in the Life of Stalin by Milan Yaroslavsky. I'm not sure if it's really still available. You can well imagine it was written and published with Stalin's approval. In it, on pages 8 and 9, we read, quote, "At a very early age, while still a pupil in the ecclesiastic school, Comrade Stalin developed a critical mind and revolutionary sentiments. He began to read Darwin and became an atheist. G. Glurgitsy, a boyhood friend of Stalin's, relates, quote, "I began to speak of God. Joseph heard me out and after a moment's silence said, 'You know, they're fooling us. There is no God.' I was astonished at these words. I never heard anything like this before. 'How can you say such a thing, So-so? That was his nickname, I exclaimed. "I'll lend you a book to read. I'll show you that the world and all living things are quite different from what you imagine, and all this talk about God is sheer nonsense,' Joseph said. 'What book is that?' I inquired. 'Darwin. You must read it,' Joseph impressed on me." End quote. But probably the most fundamental effect Darwin and his disciples had was to thoroughly discredit the Torah's view of creation and man's role within it. In the words of Michael Denton in his classic work Evolution, a Theory in Crisis, on page 67, quote, "It was because Darwinian theory broke man's link with God and set him adrift in a cosmos without purpose or end that its impact was so fundamental. No other intellectual revolution in modern times, in parentheses, with the possible exception of the Copernican, so profoundly affected the way men view themselves and their place in the universe. And because Darwin's theory was so well accepted, especially within liberal academic circles, someone who believes in the creation epic of Genesis, as it was understood since antiquity, is generally offered the same intellectual respect as one who believes in Santa Claus and the Tooth Fairy." End quote. What is truly amazing is that although the theory is generally accepted today as fact, as evolutionist Richard Dawkins so aptly put it, quote, "The theory is about as much in doubt as the earth goes around the sun," end quote, is based on virtually no empirical evidence and is widely recognized to contain grievous and persistent difficulties. Before I go into detail about the theory and its difficulties, I'd first like to present the Torah's view of creation and evolution. Because of the widespread acceptance of Darwin's theories, there have been many attempts by very well-meaning individuals to read evolution into the text of the Torah. This is based on the well-accepted principle there cannot be contradiction between the truth of God's revelation through the Torah and his revelation through science. And in theory, at least, God could well have chosen an evolutionary process over eons of time as the means of his creative activity rather than instant creation. Therefore, before we analyze the evidence for and against evolution, I would first like to share with you some of the sources from the Torah, Talmud, and the Mefarshim, the commentaries. And this is on the first page of your handouts. Let's first read together just a partial quote from the creation description of creation, narrative creation, in the first and part of the second chapter of Genesis. We start from the third day and go on to the fifth and the sixth. And the earth brought forth grass and herb yielding seed after its kind, and tree yielding fruit, whose seed was in itself after its kind. And God saw that it was good. That was the third day. And the fifth day, and God said, let the waters swarm with many kinds of living creatures, and birds that may fly above the earth and the open firmament of heaven. And God created the great sea monsters and every kind of creature that live in the waters and every kind of winged birds. And God saw that it was good. And then the sixth day, and God said, let the earth bring forth all kinds of living creatures, cattle and creeping things, and beasts of the earth after their kind. And it was so. And God made the beasts of the earth after their kind, and cattle after their kind, and everything that creeps upon the earth after its kind. And God saw that it was good. And in the second chapter, referring to the events as it happened to man, and out of the ground the Lord God formed every beast of the field and every bird of the air and brought them to Adam, to see what he would call them. And whatever Adam called every living creature, that was its name. One could see on one hand that just the basic reading of the text seemed to suggest literally the things emerged from the ground. On the other hand, one could also see that it could be understood figuratively. It was emerged over time. It's a way of describing how they came into existence. However, it's clear from the sages of the Talmud that they understood this to be taken literally. And here we start first from the Gemara in Chulin. This is in Samach Amud Beis in 60b. Rav Asi pointed out a contradiction between verses. One verse says, which we read together, the earth brought forth grass, referring to the third day. Whereas another verse, when speaking of the sixth day, said, this is in the beginning of the second chapter, no shrub of the field was yet in the earth. So how could that be? It created on the third day, and yet the sixth day, when man was there, it says there was nothing there. This teaches us that the plants commenced to grow, but stopped just as they were about to break through the soil. Until Adam came and prayed for rain. When rain fell, they sprouted forth. This teaches you that the Holy One, blessed be He, longs for the prayers of the righteous. As the events it's describing is that the plants were created, they were in their place, but nothing happened. And they only emerged later on the sixth day. If you understand, I mean, this only makes sense if we understand days to be literal days, and merging means literally merging from the ground. At least that's how the Rabbi Yossi in the Talmud understands this. The Gemara in Rosh Hashanah, Yud Aleph Amud Aleph in 11a, Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi said, all the creatures of creation were brought into being with their full stature, their full capacities, and their full beauty. Thus, it merged from the ground whole. As it says, and the heaven and the earth were finished, and all the hosts of them, tzavom. Read not tzavom, as it's hinted with the use of the word tzavom, referring to the contents, but rather tzivyonom, their beauty. Thus, it was produced in its full beauty. And we find in the Gemara in Avodah Zorah, in Chesom Ad Aleph, in 8a, Adam, after realizing that God had mercy on him after the original sin, was not going to immediately kill him, arose and offered up a bullock. There's a bull whose horns emerged before its hoofs. In other words, this was an original creation. It was an emerged whole from the ground. As it's emerging whole, the horns come first, and then the hoofs come later. As it is said, in my thanksgiving, your prayer shall please the Lord better than a bullock that has horns and hoofs. And Rashi explains, where do you see that the bullock that has horns and hoofs refers to the bullock whose horns emerge? So we quote Rashi here, whose horns were developed before its hoofs. For the Master has said, again referring to the quote we had before in Rosh Hashanah 11a, all the creatures of the creation were brought into being with their full stature, implying that their horns were already grown. And since their head emerged first, it follows that their horns preceded their hooves. And then my thanksgiving shall please the Lord better than a bullock. You know, so David said, King David, David HaMelech, and my prayer shall please Hashem more than a bovine. A shor is the generic term for bovines. In other words, from the infant, from the calf, to the full grown, they're all called, and according to the Talmud, they're all called shor, which is a generic term. The day that was born, a bovine, when it was born, which was complete as a bullock of 3 years of age. And shor par, that Pasuk says, a shor that immediately was the size of a por, which is an adult. A bullock of 3 years age, which is not lacking even its horns. In other words, the understanding of the Talmud was the animals emerged from the ground. And it was one of those animals that Adam Arishan, that Adam brought as a sacrifice, as a thanksgiving. Referring to the creation of man, and again it's described, and God formed man of the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life. Man became a living soul, which again could be interpreted theoretically on a more poetical vein. But again, it seems the Talmud understood this all literally. And describing the events of the sixth day, it's clear that they understood the sixth day not as an era, an epoch, millions of years, and man's creation taking time, but rather just as a simple day. Perhaps things were hurried up in the day, but the day was a simple day. The day consists of 12 hours. This is quoting from Rabbi Yochanan ben Chanina. It says, in the first hour, his Adam's dust was gathered. It was kneaded into a shapeless mass. In the third, his limbs were shaped. In the fourth, a soul was infused into him. In the fifth, he arose and stood on his feet. In the sixth, he gave the animals their names. In the seventh, Eve became his mate, Chava. In the eighth, they ascended to bed as two and descended as four. In other words, during that period of time, the whole process of conception, you know, pregnancy, was hurried up. In the ninth, he was commanded not to eat of the tree. In the tenth, he sinned. In the 11th, he was tried. In the 12th, he was expelled from Eden and departed. It's clear again, their understanding is the text is to be understood very literally. And here I'm quoting from another source here. This is from Sentence 65b. That although it doesn't deal with the creation directly, but I believe it sheds light onto the dynamics of the creation. Rava said, this is in Samach Hayom and Beis and Sanhedrin, if the righteous desired, they could, by living a life of absolute purity, be creators. They could create as well, not just God. As it is written, but your iniquities have distinguished between, and those have made a mechitza, havdalah, between you and God. Otherwise, you would be godlike. And it continues on, Rabba, the famous sage of the Talmud, Rabba, Bar Nachmeni, created a man and sent him to Rabbi Zera. Rabbi Zera spoke to him, but received no answer. Thereupon he said unto him, you are a creature of the magicians, return to your dust. You know, this is the story of the golem, the Maral of Prague. The idea is based on this idea. We discussed in the previous lecture about the authenticity or the question about the authenticity of the Maral story, but it's based on this idea. Rabbi Chanina and Rabbi Oisha spent every Sabbath Eve, every Shabbos, in studying the book of creation, Sefer Yetzirah, by means of which they created a third grown or choice calf and ate it. It would seem from the above that the simple meaning of the text, as well as the understanding of the Talmud, is that creation is a unique event, similar to Rabbah creating a man through Sefer Yetzirah, Rabbi Chanina or Boisha creating a calf. If one is convinced that the only way creation could have occurred is through Darwinian evolution, one could interpret the text of the Torah in poetic terms in a manner which is not contradictory to evolution. Such an approach is obviously a strained reading of the text and, in addition, does not reflect the understanding of the Talmudic sages. But this does not necessarily rule out evolution altogether, especially the type which does have supporting evidence, the type that, which, at least by inference, Darwin himself viewed. And this brings us to section 3, which on page 3, which here we have evidence of evolution. This is what we're quoting now, is the Medrash Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer. It's chapter 23, Chov Gimel. And this describes the making of Noah's Ark. And this is how you shall make the Ark. This is in Genesis 6:15. Reboisha taught, the Holy One, blessed be He, showed Noah with His finger, and His disc, clearly, and He said to him, make it in this exact manner. 150 rooms on the right, starboard, side of the length of the ark, and 150 rooms on the left, the port side of the length. 33 rooms along the walls of the width of the ark by its front, and there's a stem or four, and 32 rooms along the walls of the width of the ark by its back, the stern or aft. There were 10 rooms in the middle which functioned as storage areas for the food. 5 portholes on the right side of the length, and portholes on the left side of the length, with hydrants to open and close the stream of water. The same floor plan was used for all 3 floors of the ark. The living area of the domesticated and wild animals was on the bottom floor. The birds were in the middle floor. The top floor was used for crawling animals and for people. From here we can derive that there are 365 types of animals. In other words, each room just housed a pair of animals. 365 types of birds and 365 types of crawling creatures. There was a uniformity throughout all 3 floors. This is the Medrash, at least the Girsa. This is the Girsa of, we're going to quote from the Radal of David Luria, who was the major commentary. It was one of the Gedolim in Europe in the early 1800s. But this is his Girsa. Commenting on this Medrash, Rav David Luria in his commentary says the following. Initially, there was only a creation of the basic types of animals whose number was only 365. Afterwards, they branched out into different species or varieties due to the conditions of their varied habitats, food, and other environmental factors, similar to the goose and the duck mentioned at the end of the 5th chapter above a comma, 55a, and domesticated and wild ox, which a Talmud Yerushalmi, the 8th chapter of Kilayim, claims is actually a runaway who changed in the wild. Don't be surprised at this, for man was created as a single individual, yet we find different races of humans across the globe with different pigmentation, whites, blacks, redskins, and in between, as well as other differences in their facial features and shape of their limbs. All of this is a result of their various habitats and food, akin to how Hillel explained the reason why the feet of the Africans were broad and the eyes of the Palmyrans bleared and the heads of the Babylonians were round, which in his opinion was due to their changed environment and conditions. This is from a Gemara in Shabbos, Lamed Aleph, Omed Aleph, 31a. Similarly, regarding plants, it is common knowledge that the abundance of variation within one species is due to the soil where it is planted and other environmental factors. It's therefore not surprising there are only 365 basic types. It follows then that although the animals had undergone change from the time of creation up until the flood, nevertheless, the ruler of the world, who knows his creations, commanded Noah to take in those major species whom he knew would spread out throughout the globe and branch out into the many species and varieties that we see today. He continues on, we have to say that of those types that were very large, he took them in as babies, just understanding the dynamics of the model. In other words, it's clear from the Radal, David Luria, there's a distinction between large-scale or macroevolution, which seems to run counter to the Torah, that the specific types of meaning were separately designed and created and emerged whole from the ground. It's just like the golem that was created by Rabbah. and microevolution, which has some support from the Medrash and commentaries, as well as empirical support. It is interesting to note that Rav David Luria published his commentary in the year 1852, 7 years before Darwin published his Origin of Species. Now, you should also be mindful of the fact that this is not the only way of understanding the preservation of life during the flood, the Mabel. Ramban, Rav Moshe ben Nachmanides, in his commentary to the Torah, assumes that Noach literally took in all the various types of animals, major and minor, and that the ark could not hold these animals without a nes, without a miracle. I remember when I was, the Mashgiach in Baltimore, David Kronglass, that's all, you know, asked the question, well, then Noach could have taken a suitcase too, you know. You know, I'd have to go through the ruse of making an ark. And then explain that, like, Hashem is a mamayit anes, and even though it's a miracle, but he wants to at least look. If you didn't look too carefully, it looks natural. However, the Radal's approach, as Rav David Luria, that only the major types were taken in, and there was a subsequent evolution, is supported by the Medrash Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer that we just saw. And it's also noteworthy that this is also the approach taken by the Netziv, Naftoli Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, the Rosh Hashiva of the famed Voloshin Yeshiva, in his classic commentary to the Torah, HaMikdover. And here we have on page 5. The meaning of the phrase, according to its kind, or according to their kind, which was written in regards to plant animal life, this is Genesis 1, verse 11, is that every kind, has many sub-varieties and species, similar to the wheat plant, which has, according to the Medrash Eicha, as many varieties as numerical value of minis, which is 500. Similarly, every kind, has numerous subdivisions. At the time of creation, however, only one wheat plant emerged, the most prized of that seed, that had the potential of evolving into many different species. In other words, it's in the genome, it had the coding for all of the species that would subsequently be produced. Regarding this, did our sages say in the tractate Rosh Hashanah 11a, that all of the creatures were created b'tzivyonim, which means, according to Tosfos, the most prized with the greatest possible beauty. Because that was the unique one, but it had in it the possibility of evolving into all the various types. And he says, furthermore, in Genesis 6:20, again, the Netziv, the Talmud Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, and Amik Dover, says, according to its kind, referring to those that, referring to the taking to the ark, we've already explained in Parshas Bereishis the meaning of the term Leminehu, according to its kind, that every original creation branched out into many subcategories, although at the time of creation there only emerged one such animal. Only afterwards did they subdivide into many species and varieties. Similarly, Noah only took into the ark one kind of each animal. It included within itself over all the varieties and species that would issue from it. In other words, again, according to this school of thought, there definitely is evolution. What we call microevolution within certain types that were already cast. And there's no... the idea that there are certain basic types that can't be bridged is really the belief of the early biologists before Darwin. This is called typology. Even the original fathers of paleontology, Richard Owens and others, also believed that the divisions are fixed. There's only change within the division. To appreciate what inspired Darwin to come up with his theory and why his explanation seemed, at least at the time, so plausible, I would like to begin the next section of this lecture with a brief overview of the history of the theory of evolution and the worldview that it displaced. At the age of 22, shortly after receiving a degree in divinity from Cambridge, Charles Darwin decided to put off entering the ministry for which he trained and to join Captain Robert Fitzroy, and the crew of HMS, His Majesty's ship Beagle, on a scientific expedition as an unpaid naturalist. It means a biologist and geologist. The Beagle set sail on December 27, 1831, to study the Pacific coast of South America and some Pacific islands, as well as to set up navigational stations in that area. By the time he returned 5 years later, it seems that he was in the process of becoming a very changed man. It is interesting to note that in his personal letters, he refers to his views as he embarked on the Beagle in the following words. Quote, "I did not then in the least doubt the strict literal truth of every word in the Bible," end quote. Unlike what we quoted from the Medrash Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer and the Pirush of the Radal, or David Luria and the Tziv, the accepted thinking at the time was that all of the different species, not just the major groups, were individually created by God and could never be changed. This is known as the doctrine of fixity of species, and as they're fixed. During his travels, especially his explorations of the Galapagos Islands, a group of some 13 volcanic islands, 600 miles west of Ecuador, South America, Darwin found an impressive array of animal life and discovered that related but different species lived on different islands. Even though all the islands were very similar in geological, climatic, and other physical conditions. He found, for example, a large variety of finches with beaks ranging from large and powerful to small or fine. He correlated these differences not with physical conditions on the islands, but with birds' feeding habits. Those with powerful beaks ate large seeds. Those with smaller beaks ate small seeds. Those with fine beaks primarily fed on insects. Those were sharp and long. He then postulated that each finch was particularly suited to the food that was available in its environment. An example of what later became known as adaptation. These birds are known today as Darwin's finches. He also observed that along the Pacific coast of South America, that closely related species often lived in adjacent geographic areas, and that species found on isolated oceanic islands often resembled species found on the nearest continent with slight differences. He kept a detailed journal of his discoveries and thoughts, which he eventually published. Eventually, he was led to the conclusion, not unlike that of David Luria, that these islands had been populated by a few individuals from the coast of South America and had changed in the face of its environment. In the world, in the words of Charles Darwin in his journal of his voyage on the Beagle, same as page 365, quote, "Seeing this gradation and diversity of structure in one small, intimately related group of birds, one might really fancy that from an original paucity of birds in this archipelago, one species had been taken and modified for different ends," end quote. From his background and training, the idea that species had changed and were not created exactly in their form was simply heresy. In the letter that he wrote on the 11th of January, 1844, a little over 7 years after he came back to England, he returned to England on October of 1836, he wrote to a friend, Joseph Hooker, the following confession, quote, "I was so struck with the distribution of the Galapagos organisms," he continues, "in the character of the American fossil mammifers," and it continues, "that I determined to collect blindly every sort of fact which could bear any way on what are species." And he continues, "At last gleams of light have come, and I am almost convinced," and he says in parentheses, "quite contrary to the opinion I started with, that species are not," and he says in parentheses, it's like confessing a murder, "immutable." Because the doctrine that he was trained with was that nothing could change. Besides for the biblically based doctrine of fixity and immutability of the minim kinds, which is then widely understood to refer to the many hundreds of thousands of living and fossil species, another reason why the idea of the immutability of the species was so appealing to the leading scientists of that time was the change of species, especially in a natural setting, was never directly observed. Even Darwin's hypothesis of the varied species in the Galapagos Islands were due to change over time and the respective special environments was only based on circumstantial evidence. It was never directly observed, at least not in Darwin's times. This is an aside, just recently studies on the Galapagos Islands. There was a period of drought during the time. And as a result, I guess there was a change in the nuts. And there was observed a change in the beaks, which seemed to support the only problem with that, is that as soon as it started raining again, the beaks changed back to what they originally were, which is something we'll discuss a little later. But there is very little independent empirical evidence, maybe much circumstantial evidence, but very, very little that has been observed. Even if his idea was correct, that the earlier life forms changed over time, Darwin felt that these changes could only have occurred over an immense amount of time. If all of history only encompassed some 6,000 years, the biblical dating system that Darwin had embraced before he embarked on the Beagle, there was too little time for nature to make such changes. Again, if the changes are done providentially, that's another, but he didn't believe in this. It was a question of just happening by chance, by these, it would have to take a long time. On this trip, Darwin not only changed his original views regarding the fixity of the species, but also his original views regarding the age of the earth. For this, Darwin owed a tremendous debt of gratitude to Sir Charles Lyell, one of the preeminent geologists of his time, whose book, The Principles of Geology, was given to him by Captain Fitzroy as a welcoming gift to accompany him on his voyage. Up until Lyell's time, the geological and fossil record of the Earth was viewed as a record of the tremendous catastrophes that shaped the Earth's surface, which laid down layer upon layer of sediment and volcanic rock and ash and exterminated life repeatedly. These catastrophes could have theoretically taken place over a relatively short period of time, akin to the Mabel, the Great Flood. And therefore, the record of sedimentation or erosion was no direct indication of the Earth's age. We find, just as an aside, and we'll discuss in a future lecture, when Mount St. Helena erupted, it was in 1980, when it erupted, it created hundreds of feet of sedimentation, which would have taken normally millions of years, took over instantly. And this is only one volcano. Imagine if thousands would have come. But this is to be discussed at another time. This view is known as catastrophism, which was held by the preeminent geologists of the early 19th century, Baron George Cuvier and William Buckland, and dominated educated thinking at least up until the year 1830. This was the year that Lyell published the first volume of Principles of Geology, where he brilliantly articulated his view, echoing the view of James Hutton, one of the previous century, that, quote, the present is the key to the past, unquote. And the geological phenomena as a whole could be explained not by repeated catastrophes, but rather in terms of currently observed natural processes operating gradually over long periods of time, i.e. erosion, sedimentation, glaciations or glaciers, etc., a concept known as uniformitarianism. According to Lyell, the Earth is not thousands of years old, but rather many millions. This, of course, is the view which is accepted today. The geological record, according to Lyell, was not a record of catastrophes, but rather the almost imperceptibly normal processes of erosion, sedimentation, etc., which over time have changed the face of the Earth. We'll deal at length with the concepts of catastrophism and uniformitarianism in a future lecture. Without Lyell's time scale of many millions of years, the evolution envisioned by Darwin would have been impossible. Darwin himself wrote in his Origin of Species, quote, "Therefore, a man should examine for himself the great piles of superimposed strata and watch the rivulets bringing down mud and the waves wearing away the sea cliffs in order to comprehend something about the duration of past time." Continues, "Nothing impresses the mind with a vast duration of time, according to our ideas of time, more forcibly than the conviction thus gained that subaerial agencies, which apparently have so little power, which seem to work so slowly, have produced great results." And it continues on, "He who can read Sir Charles Lyell's grand work on the principles of geology, and yet does not admit how vast have been the past periods of time, may at once close this volume." This is in chapter 10 of The Origin of Species. It is no small wonder that Darwin dedicated the publication of the second edition of his journal of the Voyage of the Beagle to Lyell. Since Darwin was convinced that the form of an animal is not fixed and immutable, but can change over time from one species to another, what some call the special theory of evolution, it only makes sense to him, it was entirely within reason, to suggest that perhaps all of life is actually the product of an original organism whose descendants kept on changing over eons of time to produce the rich variety we have now and which is recorded in the fossil record, which is we call the general theory of evolution. But at this point, though, Darwin faced an immense problem. What induced these small changes in these animals or plants that would make them change over time? The truth is that the modern idea of evolution and the non-fixity of species was not originated by Darwin. Others before him had suggested it, the most noteworthy being the French naturalist Jean-Baptiste Lamarck. This is the author of a two-volume work called Zoological Philosophy. In this work, he not only proposed the idea that all forms had evolved through time, and like Lyell and Hutton, maintained that changes the Earth had undergone have occurred through slow natural processes and not through catastrophes, but he also suggested the mechanism for such change. According to Lamarck, animals and plants change somewhat as a response to the environment and pass these acquired changes on to the next generation. Most scientists of his time and afterwards rejected Lamarck's theory, not just because of their belief in the Bible, because Lamarck's theory that acquired traits are inheritable, in other words, was extremely speculative as well as very limited explaining all facets of evolution. You know, the idea that the some primal animal that eventually changed into a whale wanted to swim, you know, so it swam and it swam, and therefore its child naturally became good at swimming, you know, and that changed. Perhaps many of you are familiar with the experiment performed by the German naturalist August Weismann, who supposedly disproved Lamarck, and which is by cutting off the tails of succeeding generations of mice without having any effect on their descendants. That's the question of that it really disproves Lamarck or not. But traits and abilities acquired by the parents do not automatically translate into improvements in their children. If you keep on practicing piano, your child will not be the next Van Cliburn. Yeah. Darwin personally violently rejected Lamarck in a letter to Lyell called Lamarck's theory, quote, absurd and, quote, rubbish, and his zoological philosophy, he said, quote, a wretched book, end quote. Evidently, he just didn't like it. Another alternative, which was held by later-day evolutionists, is what is known today as theistic evolution or vitalism or orthogenesis. According to this view, God or some spiritual force guided the evolutionary process, causing the adaptive changes for the maximum benefit of the respective life forms. In a certain sense, echoing the Medrash that we touched upon in a previous lecture, that every blade of grass has its own guardian angel. To Darwin, who was increasingly becoming an agnostic, this approach was probably worse than the classical biblical creationism. We explained in the previous lecture that Darwin had great difficulty dealing with problems of suffering in this world and felt, along with many others of his time, that God, although he may have been a creator, was certainly not supervising this world. Otherwise, the argument went, how could he possibly tolerate the suffering and injustice that fills the world? In the words of Darwin in his letter to Dr. Asa Gray, which we quoted in a previous lecture, quote, I cannot persuade myself that a beneficent and omnipotent God would have designedly created the ichneumonidae, these are parasitic wasps, that express intention of their feeding within the living bodies of caterpillars. In other words, they lay their eggs within the caterpillars, and as they grow, they eat the living caterpillars. Or that a cat should play with mice, end quote. For Darwin, it's hard enough for him to believe in a creator who created the world in the distant past and somehow forgot about his creation. It was all the more difficult for him to believe that the creator is constantly at work supervising his creation. For him, such a solution was unthinkable. He was convinced that many, if not all, life forms had evolved, but he knew of no acceptable method, except, of course, by some intelligence who was guiding this, by which it could have happened. It was only after reading a book by the famous English economist Thomas Robert Malthus, 2 years after the completion of his voyage on the Beagle, that Darwin finally felt that he had the answers as to how evolution worked. In his classic work, An Essay on the Principle of Population as it Affects the Future Improvement of Society, which he wrote in 1798, Malthus pointed out what he felt to be the limits of continuing human progress, that population would continue to remain unchecked. In a later revised edition, which he published 5 years later, he suggested that mankind's only solution was to limit population by delaying marriage and practicing abstinence. In other words, if they would practice some form of birth control. According to Malthus, population, when unchecked by war, famine, or disease, would increase by a geometric ratio. There's two people, if two people have not just two, but four, and they intermarry later on, it keeps on growing. It just doesn't, keeps on, it's four, next week's four by four, by four, by four, as it keeps on expanding geometrically. But substance only progresses through arithmetically. As you add a little bit more in a year, you add produce in more year, you can't possibly increase your productivity at the same rate as you're increasing population if you have many more than two kids. As if you don't, if you're going to have four kids, and each one of those kids is going to have four kids, and each one of those kids is going to have four kids, and for a while you're going to run out of food. And he felt, therefore, that eventually there'll be not enough food to feed an ever-growing population. So far, Malthus's dire predictions have remained unfulfilled, as mankind has devised new and ingenious ways to increase food production. It was Malthus's vision of a desperate, burgeoning population fighting over limited food supply that inspired Darwin to arrive at his theory. In Darwin's own words in his autobiography on page 83, we read, quote, in October of 1838, I happened to read for amusement Malthus on population, and being well prepared to appreciate the struggle for existence, which everywhere goes on from long continued observation of the habits of animals and plants, it once struck me that under these circumstances, favorable variations would tend to be preserved and unfavorable ones to be destroyed. The result of this work would be formation of new species. Here, then, I had at least got a theory by which to work. Darwin was intimately aware of the changes that breeders could affect in pigeons. And by specifically selecting certain traits or features, they could artificially create whole new varieties. With his understanding of nature based on Malthus, Darwin proposed that through the competition for scarce resources, nature itself could act as a breeder, eliminating inferior types and selecting only those most fit. And this change, which Darwin envisioned, did not have to be limited and remain within the boundaries of the species. In Darwin's own words in his Origin of Species, quote, "I can see no limit to the amount of change, to the beauty and complexity of the co-adaptation between all organic beings, one with the other, and with their physical conditions of life, which may have been affected in the long course of time through nature's power of selection, that is, by the survival of the fittest." In other words, just as breeders select the best animal for further breeding, so too, in the competitive environment of scarce resources, nature favors the most fit, those that have some advantage, speed, strength, shape of its limbs, coloring, etc. The most fit will survive and the others will die out. In turn, the most superior of its descendants will survive and further improve the species, so much so that over time may no longer totally resemble the ancestor from which it all began. At last, Darwin had discovered a means of explaining the creation without a creator, which also solved the problem of the existence of evil. In Darwin's own words, taken from his autobiography on page 90, quote, "A being so powerful and so full of knowledge as a God who could create the universe is to our finite minds omnipotent and omniscient. It revolts our understanding to suppose that his benevolence is not unbounded. For what advantage can there be in the sufferings of millions of lower animals through almost endless time? This very old argument from the existence of suffering against the existence of an intelligent first cause seems to me a strong one. And the abundant presence of suffering agrees well with the view that organic beings have been developed through variation and natural selection." End quote. In other words, this was a way of understanding what happens in the world. There is, according to Darwin, there is no God. There is no compassionate creator. All that happens is merely the result of natural law, of change through natural selection. It is important to mention at this point that we've already touched upon the very difficult subject of suffering in general, and specifically in the animal world, in a previous lecture in the series. We explained that the mystery of suffering is very likely linked to the mystery of reincarnation, which even touches the animal world, as we quoted from the Shulah in the name of Shlomo Alkovitz. The Christian world, which to this day refuses to believe in reincarnation, is very hard-pressed to answer this most vexing problem. Why do animals suffer? For those who believe in reincarnation, the problem of evil and suffering takes on an entirely different dimension. Despite all of Darwin's enthusiasm which he infected others, he realized there was virtually no, as we said before, virtually no empirical evidence to support his theory. In Darwin's own words in a letter to a friend, quote, "The belief in natural selection must at present be grounded entirely on general considerations." Continues on, "We descend to details. We cannot prove that a single species has changed, nor can we prove that the supposed changes are beneficial, which is the groundwork of the theory," end quote. He can't prove it. He just has all this circumstantial evidence which strongly supports it. In addition, over the years, various difficulties with this theory became evident. First and foremost, breeding by itself cannot produce new species. What he wanted to say is that over time, natural selection, the survival of fittest, will accomplish what a human breeder will accomplish, who has a clear-cut goal, who will kill off, who will remove certain offspring and only save these that have special qualities. But they realized that a breeder has a limit to what he can breed. First and foremost, breeding itself cannot produce new species. They can only modify existing structures, as Francis Hitching pointed out in his book, neck of the giraffe. This is on page 55. Every series of breeding experiments has ever taken place has established a finite limit to breeding possibilities. Genes are a strong influence for conservatism and allow only modest change. Left to their own devices, artificially bred species usually die out because they are sterile, less robust, or quickly revert to the norm. End quote. And the words of the famous American plant breeder Luther Burbank, quote, there are limits to the developments possible, and these limits follow a law. Plants and animals all tend to revert in successive generations toward a given mean or average. And in the words of one of 20th century's most eminent geneticists, Richard Goldsmith, who was at the University of California, Berkeley, himself an ardent evolutionist, he believed, just by the way, his theory, which was dismissed by his colleagues, was that evolution, he believed in evolution, because he didn't believe, basically, he didn't believe in God. I mean, if you don't believe, I mean, if you are convinced philosophically that there cannot be a God, I mean, just as Darwin, because of the suffering, this is the only explanation. He felt that the fossil evidence doesn't support, as we'll discuss in a future lecture, Darwin's view of evolution. There are no small changes. All the changes are great, happen at once. And he believed, therefore, what he calls macromutation, that things changed all of a sudden. The problem is, how do they change so suddenly? I mean, we're speaking about a major change, not to make a monster, but to make whole new, you're making whole new organs, whole new systems. And of course, his colleagues dismissed his view. But in defending himself, he writes, it is true that nobody thus far has produced a new species or a genus itself by macromutation, meaning a sudden dramatic change. It is equally true that nobody has ever produced even a species by the selection of micromutation. There's the other one, there's no evidence to support that either. So that's one problem. Of course, if you believe in it and there's no other way, it happened, that's all. You don't see it, it happened. Maybe, you know, but it happened. I you don't see it and there's no evidence. Okay. For the Kasha Stoutmanish, I don't dive a question. You can live with it, but it happened. But it is a problem. That basically what he wanted to say occurs, we can't reproduce this. A second problem that Darwin faced was that even propitious variations amongst animals tend to be watered down by interbreeding. Or at least that was the commonly held belief at the time. You know, unless, which is the means that they want to get, that it happened, that evolution could only occur in isolated populations, small isolated populations. Because let's say, for instance, let's say we have somebody, let's say among a human population that has some special quality. They have ability to hear or to see or to think. But they have to marry somebody who doesn't have that ability. And those kids are going to marry other people. After a while, they tend to be watered down. With the theory of genetics in terms of dominant, you know, about the whole idea of dominant traits versus recessive traits, they try to get away from this, saying, but if the lucky mutation happens to have the feature of dominance, then that won't be a problem. It'll constantly dominate, perhaps. But that is a problem that himself Darwin struggled with, the idea of being watered down. Even Darwin admitted the problem. In his fifth edition of The Origin of Species, he writes, quote, I saw that the preservation in the state of nature of any natural deviation of structure, such as a monstrosity, would be a rare event, and that if preserved, it would generally be lost by subsequent intercrossings with ordinary individuals. Nevertheless, until reading an able and valuable article in the North British Review, this is in 1867 by Fleming Jenkins, I did not appreciate how rarely single variations, whether slight or strongly marked, could be perpetuated. Does he realize this is a problem? Because it isn't a question pointing out this evolved or that evolved. It's a question everything evolved. So if it's so rare, he says, how could everything evolve? Even if it happens, it's going to be watered down and lost. Besides for the fact that evolution, at least as conceived by Darwin, was not directly observed, and the favorable qualities of individuals tend to be diluted in the gene pool, there's a third difficulty with this theory. It's important to realize, something which Darwin himself never recognized, that the entire doomsday scenario of Malthus, i.e. the brutal struggle of exploding population over limited resources, with only the fittest surviving, does not actually occur in the animal world. As Dr. Lee Spetner pointed out in his marvelous little book, Not by Chance, I don't know if you, Dr. Lee is a brother of Kenny Spetner from St. Louis. Quoting V.C. Wynne Edwards' book, Evolution Through Group Selection, he says, quote, population size is not controlled by starvation, disease, or predation. In most animal populations, starvation diseases are rare. They occur only as the result of extraordinary catastrophes such as epidemics or droughts. Population size seems to be kept in check by intrinsic forces that regulate the animal population, preventing overpopulation. End quote. Like it's built in. Whether the cause of this internal force is providential or built-in genetic control is something which we'll soon speak. In addition, it has been discovered that predators, with the exception of man, do not overexploit prey populations. Animal predators generally take only the excess of the prey population. So they don't hunt them to, this is only the fastest one. They take very few. Furthermore, quoting an article by A.D. Bradshaw published in Advances in Genetics, Dr. Spetner pointed out that similarly, plants do not engage in a struggle for survival. When growth is dense, the plant instinctively produces less seeds. When growth is thin, they produce more seeds. It's the Malach, you know. There is a built-in mechanism to prevent Malthusian competition. In the light of this, the whole Darwinian premise seems to be totally unfounded. Besides these three objections, one, the paucity of empirical evidence to evolution, two, the dilution of positive traits in the gene pool, and three, the fact that Malthusian model of the struggle of diminishing resources resulting with the survival of the fittest is simply not empirically true. There's yet a fourth critique of the theory, which is perhaps the most important. Let me explain. Today, when we speak of evolution, we generally are not strictly referring to Darwin's theory, but rather a new theory only partially based on Darwin. According to this new theory called the modern synthetic theory of evolution, what actually fuels the evolutionary process is not the variations that already exist in the gene pool of the species. As we point out the problem, an evolutionist totally today readily admit that Darwin was mistaken in this, and that normal variations within the species cannot produce evolutionary change. Maybe you can make thick beaks, thin beaks, but the beak is the beak. That beak's not going to change into a hand. You know, I mean, what you have is really variations within the kind. But rather, they believe today that it is fueled by the accumulation of slight random mutations or mistakes that occur when the cell copies the existing information contained within the gene. Now, when they came up with this theory, which was in the 1930s and 40s, because of the problems, they did not have the information we have today. I mean, they didn't know about the DNA. I mean, they didn't have the information. How frequent are these mutations? We know mutations occur. But how frequent are they? They didn't know at the time that this synthetic theory was developed. But we know that they occur at a frequency of about 1 in a billion to 1 in 100 billion per copy. In other words, the DNA, which, again, this is not for this year, Mr. Shem, for next year, has a built-in checking process. Because not only do but they automatically root out errors. And it's a brilliant... You see what evolution can do? It's amazing. So it's very rare that a mistake could go through. Because there's a whole elaborate checking system to make sure if it's a mistake, it's killed. I mean, it's just redone. So if you have 1 in a billion to 1 in 100 billion per copy, which is a very rare occurrence under normal circumstances, I mean, with repeated, you know, massive doses of radiation, it could change. But under normal circumstances, it's very rare. So how could these extremely improbable events be the cause of all the variety and complexity that exists in nature is a real challenge to the theory. In addition, the vast majority of these infrequent mutations are harmful for the organism. A mistake is a mistake. A helpful mutation or copying error, if it exists at all, is extremely rare. And then the only help it provides, generally, is only of a secondary nature. For instance, experiments have been made with Drosophila. These are fruit flies, which are exposed to all kinds of mutant producing high levels of radiation. When there's a lot of radiation, the mistakes go up. But of all of mutations produced, it seems none of them seem to have been positive. You have these giants. You have extra wings that can't fly. You have extra this, extra that. I mean, it's basically as if I wanted a typist to copy over 2 pages from Shakespeare's play. And we know that there's a certain amount of error, every typist, even the best typist. So there's a few errors here. Has Shakespeare been improved? When I will read this now, will it be a better reading of Shakespeare? You know, here you have a code. We will go into detail later what this code is. We have a very complex code. It's like a computer code. There are programmers in the audience. When you make a difference, you make a change in a comma or a period. That's the end of your program. Today, it's very easy. In the old days, you first had to run it over this massive machine and found the mistake, then try to find it. The error took days and days. So the mistakes should be beneficial. The mistakes exist is a rarity. And that the mistake should be beneficial is even a greater rarity, if it exists at all. There are beneficial mistakes, but when they occur, at least the ones that we find, they're a side effect of the crippling of the mutation. For instance, the debilitating disease sickle cell anemia is a result of a mutation on a specific location on the gene that produces hemoglobin, the oxygen-carrying protein in red blood cells. Because the hemoglobin is misshaped and malformed, that's why it causes so much pain, that's a terrible one. Due to the mutation, it resists the malaria parasite, this is Plasmodium, which only interacts with normal hemoglobin. So therefore it has a benefit. There's a person who has this sickness, and therefore you can have a situation where the population could be wiped out by malaria and those with sickle cell anemia will survive. So here they have something positive, but they survived at the cost of having this debilitating disease. Another example is a mutation of bacteria that makes it resistant to the drug streptomycin. There are many different things. These are only examples. Mutation is an area of the gene which contains the code to produce ribosomes. That's the cellular machine that helps the transcription of the information, DNA, to produce specific proteins. I mean, we'll go into detail, Mr. Shem, in the future, how it works. We'll have to we'll produce a chart and everything. With this mutation, the bacteria produces a defective and misshapen ribosome, which is slower than normal in translating the DNA code. But it also has a positive side effect. Because it is defective and misshapen, the streptomycin molecule that generally attaches itself to the ribosome of a normal bacteria interferes with its protein-making ability, cannot get a grip on the deformed ribosome, and has no effect on it. Providentially, then, its chesor and its defect is its myelin saving quality. But as Dr. Spetner pointed out, these rare providential defects can no way be the source of the complex organisms and their even more complex DNA coding. Now, this we'll speak of in greater detail, Mirz Hashem, in a future lecture. In other words, all evidence points to the fact that everything that we see, all the diversity of life and its complexity, is not the product of mere chance, but rather of intelligent design, and that the distinct minim types which occupy this world could not have been created by mere mutations, copying errors, and neither could all of the complex organs and systems of our body. They all give testimony, inspired us, as we discussed in the previous lecture, to the greatness of Hashem. But if change is not possible through a process of mutations and survival of the fittest, assume so, how did the animals of the ark, the Teva, change into the various subgroupings that we see today? Dr. Lee Spetner, again, in his books, Is Not By Chance, presents the hypothesis that just as the DNA of the cell is programmed to create the entire organism and regulate it, a miracle of unparalleled magnitude, which we'll explain in a future lecture, it also programmed with the ability to make slight changes in its phenotype, the body plan, or its ability in order the organism survive in a new hostile environment. In other words, it's pre-programmed to make changes. According to Dr. Spetner, the coding for this is already inherent in the DNA of the cell and is waiting to be turned on in the presence of certain environmental cues. So in other words, that mean, and this is like the Netziv says, the mean, the original one, had in it the ability to change. Dr. Spetner supports this thesis with an abundance of research. And again, the ability that things change on cues in the environment is not Darwinian evolution. The Darwinian evolution is an atheistic evolution, that it's merely chance. And the environment, really, according to their understanding, does not force it. The changes happen by themselves. All the environment can do is weed out those that are less fit. The idea of survival of the fittest doesn't create evolution. The changes that occur naturally occur. It weeds out the less fit, and therefore the best survive. But be no way to say that the changes are caused by the environment. All the environment can do is make the better ones survive. I mean, that's the Darwinian model. This is a different model. As we read through the early in lecture, this is really the thesis of David Luria, the Radal. And as I would like to conclude this lecture by quoting some of the supporting evidence of this thesis from pages 187, 188 of Dr. Spetner's book. And this is the first thing from page 187. This is Barbara McClintock, who received the Nobel Prize in 1983 for her work on genetic rearrangements. In other words, there is a idea that it's not a mistake in the copying, but really you've taken a piece and like turned it around and just rearranged it. This is not the mutation that we're talking about, that there's an error and just read it wrong, like a typist who reads it wrong. You've taken a piece. Like an editor. You've taken this paragraph and moved it from the top of the page to the bottom of the page. And this can result in resistance to antibiotics. notes that there are indications that these genetic modifications occur in response to stress, and as they don't randomly occur, but actually do recur, you know, as a result of the cues from the environment. And he continues on. Barry Wanner of Emory University suggested that genomic rearrangements could be part of a control system in bacteria that will produce heritable changes in response to environmental cues. Virginia Walbert of Stanford University and Christopher Cullis, later at Case Western Reserve University, have noted that genetic rearrangements can be responsible for rapid genetic changes, especially in plants. Now, through his genetic rearrangements, is the rearrangement of already existing genetic material. It's there already. And there's a special mechanism with special coding and specifically designed proteins that make these rearrangements. Now, they're also coded. This just doesn't happen. Because what makes them do it? Over a decade ago, Barry Hall, then at the University of Connecticut, prepared a strain of E. coli bacteria that could not break down the milk sugar lactose. Normal E. coli can live on lactose because they have an array of enzymes that can metabolize it. For this set of experiments, Hall prepared a strain that lacked the gene encoding the first enzyme of the array. Because of this lack, his strain of bacteria could not live on lactose. When these bacteria grew and multiplied on another nutrient, but in the presence of lactose, and there was lactose there, but they couldn't eat it. There was another nutrient that they could eat. Two mutations were found to appear in the same bacterium. One of these mutations was in a hitherto unknown structural gene, and the other was in its control gene. The mutated structural gene encodes an enzyme that could perform the missing first step in the lactose metabolism. Because of the mutant bacteria activated a substitute gene, as the regular one was taken out. But now it activated a substitute. It was able to live on lactose. Now the new ones could live on lactose. The gene that mutated had been present all along, but it was dormant. Its normal function is unknown. Hall called it a cryptic gene. It was there waiting to be turned on. Neither of the above two mutations is of any use by itself to the bacterium. For the bacterium to metabolize lactose, both mutants have to occur. In the absence of lactose, these two mutations are independent. They will occur together only by chance and will do so only with a small probability of only 10 to the minus 18th power. In other words, you have a point and 17 zeros and a 1. This is Hall calculated for his population the expected waiting time for both these mutations to occur by chance. He found that if they really did occur at random, it would have to be wait for about 100,000 years before it could expect to see one of these double mutations. But in the presence of lactose, he found 40 of them in just a few days. These results suggest that the lactose in the environment induced these mutations. Dr. Spender went on for several more pages quoting various studies to support this thesis. In summation, that's why he says not by chance. That's the name of his book. In other words, he believes there is evolutionary change. It occurs, like the Radal says, within the mean, within the type, but it is programmed that it can change. In summation, in this lecture, we quoted from various sources that strongly suggest that the original creation created certain unbridgeable types, meanim. These types were modified over time to produce the abundance of variety amongst the different types or genera or species. The ability to change is not random or happenstance, but is built into the bria, the creation itself. We trace the story of how Charles Darwin arrived at his theory that evolution is the product of blind chance, according to Darwin, and good fortune, and the cruel competition for limited resources, as he envisioned it in Malthusian terms. He also pointed out the problem of evil in the world is what prompted Darwin to reject the most obvious solution of a directed evolution. Even if you assume that there is evolution, the obvious thing was the intelligence who designed this directed the change. But it was something that he ruled out. We also touch upon the Kabbalistic doctrine of reincarnation to explain much of the mystery of God's workings in both the human and subhuman world. We also pointed out the drawbacks of Darwin's explanation of the mechanism of change, as well as the incorrectness of the Malthusian model in the animal and plant kingdom. Finally, we quoted Dr. Lee Spetner's thesis of evolutionary change, something not dependent on mere chance or copying errors, something built into the original genome, genetic code itself. There's also the approach taken by Rav David Luria, the Radal, in his commentary to the Medrash Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer. Since it's our thesis, that this is, we said in the previous lecture, the original creation was specifically designed to inspire fear and love of God, and is most clearly the work of a superintelligence, I would like to devote the next lecture to one area which often creates great confusion and is used as a prop to support the atheistic approach to evolution. This is the fossil record, and that is the subject of the next lecture. Now, are there any questions?
That's the first question.
Yes, the first question is, does a Torah... The idea of minor changes... Right.
But for example, the causation is response to on prostate surgery. They say we used to have two openings, maybe he's talking about the urethra or something, and now he says that doesn't exist anymore. That's Nishtana Hatev. That would be, I guess, like a micro...
That's right. That would be the idea of Nishtana Hatev. The changes, there are constant changes.
Okay. And then just go back and then turn into
So the question, there's two questions. Let me just... First, the question is in the Torah's view, how view evolutionary changes, and second, about the creation of the development of man could be understood in evolutionary terms. The thrust of this lecture was, at least we see in what seemed clearly from the Medrash, about only 365 types, that evolution is a constant process. Just as Darwin would say there was one original organism that evolved, so he would say that there's 365 of this and 365 of that, 365 of that. And there are certain, not one, but many primary organisms that later evolve. That seems to be, that's what they're saying. In terms of the evolution of man, see, there's, if we read the simple meaning of the text, if you read it, before Darwin, we are not in the year 1859, we're in the year 1858. Right? The origin has not been published yet, and we're reading the text. There'd be no way that you would assume that it's referring to the development of lower species to create man. I mean, you just wouldn't look at it that way. It's only because today, in Darwinian terms, that we could perhaps read this into the text. I can't say that it cannot be read into the text. All I can say is what I said is, but that was not the understanding of the Talmud. If someone is firmly convinced on the basis of the evidence that evolution, as it was understood by Darwin, is not that we describe within the third, but the Darwinian evolution is a fact, one could understand the Torah. Now, there are many... this is the way that they could view the Torah and view what they feel as fact, and this is the resolution that they have. The Torah is only speaking in poetic terms. This is not the traditional view, and in my opinion, it's a very strained way. If there's absolutely no solution, you'd say, I don't believe, as we'll continue on, that first of all, again, it says that's not the way the Talmud understood this. And the simple reading, it says, he took the dust, and he made this, and he made that, and he made the other thing. I mean, he had the gorilla already before. The gorilla slept, and then the baby was a mazel tov. It came out of them. When you read it, you don't see it. You really have to, it's really a strained reading. The only thing, you're forced because the evidence forces you. So as we're going to see, this is in the future lectures, the evidence, I believe, doesn't exist, A. And B, it's a forced reading. But if someone actually does maintain this, I don't believe they're out of the fold. But I just don't believe it's correct. Okay? I got that.